want to ask you about the marketplace that you and MJ arrived as a duo into, sort of the timing of his career simultaneous to the globalization of basketball, the growth of cable. How new and wide open was this marketplace for you and for Mike?
Well, it's really hard for your listeners to understand this, but if you could analogize when Michael came into the NBA in 1984 to 1492 when Columbus discovered America, and people thought the world was flat. So you take the greatest players in the game. Magic Johnson comes out as the number one pick in 1979, wins the NBA championship as a rookie playing center. Gets the MVP, Rookie of the Year, Larry Bird, Dr. J. Those guys had no endorsements. It's hard to believe. Magic had a one-year deal with 7-Up, and other than Spalding basketball, Converse shoes, he had no national deal. So when players today talk about their brands and globalization and whatever, none of that existed in 1984. And Michael single-handedly broke down every barrier of race, you know, gender, that existed, all the biases that people had. And he created an entire marketplace for today's generation of LeBrons and Kobe's and Steph Curry's and Kevin Durant's and Zion Williamson's. That stuff just didn't exist.
And David, how were you guys able to accomplish that? I mean, how was it that this one player, when the other great players in the NBA, like you said, did not have a lot of endorsements, how were you guys able to work together and make him into the global icon he is?
Well, first of all, I mean, he became a global icon because he was the greatest player of all time. And it was a great honor for me as a very young lawyer, age 33, I've been in the business for 10 years, to have a chance to work on a clean canvas with a person of his talent, intelligence, drive. And fortunately, in the first 10 years of my career, I had a chance to be like the junior agent for two world-class tennis players, Arthur Ashe and Stan Smith. And tennis players, like golfers and boxers, have tons of endorsements. They have their own line of rackets and shoes and clothes. So when Michael came out in 1984, what put him on a world stage was the Olympics. 1984 is the last year, if you recall, that college players played the Olympics. And Michael dominated the Olympics in Los Angeles, in America, on a world stage before probably a billion viewers. He came out of the very tightly organized offense that he played at North Carolina. I mean, the running joke for the last 40 years, but the only person alive that ever kept Michael Jordan under 20 points was Coach Smith at North Carolina. And he played with James Worthy, who was the number one pick in the draft. Brad Daugherty was the number one pick in the draft. He played with some great players, Matt Daugherty, Ken, you know. And so Michael played a team game. But at the Olympics, he just freaking dominated the Olympics. And nobody knew at the time how good he'd be, but they knew he'd be very exciting. And so my challenge representing him, it wasn't the first great player we ever had. It wasn't the first great player in Carolina. We represented James Worthy. Phil Ford was the National Player of the Year. But, you know, it was to try to do something different. Like, I was tired of doing the same thing over and over again. I didn't want to be a plumber. I wanted to try to be an artist. And Michael's tremendous personality and his talent, his drive, gave me an opportunity to try things that had never been tried before. And we used all our contacts in the world of corporate marketing to lean on people and get Michael started. Once he got started and people saw how amazing he was both on the court and off the court as a spokesman, the thing took off. But it wasn't like people calling and saying, God, we got to have Michael Jordan. People didn't believe that an African-American player in a team sport could become a spokesman on Madison Avenue. They just didn't believe it. Today, you know, the young players of today really owe a tremendous debt to Michael Jordan for breaking down all those barriers.
longtime Jordan agent David Falk is with us here on Spain and Company on ESPN Radio. I heard you created the name Air Jordan, and this was a part of what you're speaking about. There weren't that many endorsements, especially for team sports. But you sat down with Nike and said, instead of giving me a number that you're going to pay, give me a presentation. What are you doing with this player and with this brand? And that eventually evolved into the shoe wars of the 90s. But take me back to that decision to say, we want to do things differently with this guy and this product.
Well, 2 years before Michael came out in 1982, we represented James Worthy, who's the only player in NBA history who was drafted number one by a team that had just won the championship. Never happened before, and it never happened since. It's been a lot of years since 1982, almost 40 years. And Worthy got the highest shoe deal in history by like 50%. More than Magic Johnson on the same team, more than Kareem Jabbar on the same team, more than Larry Bird, Dr. J, anybody. And when Michael came out, to me, it wasn't simply about money. I wanted to make Michael to be like a tennis player or a golfer. I wanted him to have his own line of products and make royalties. And most of the companies just didn't conceive that that could possibly work for a basketball player, particularly on a team that was really lousy in Chicago, that wasn't the number one pick in the draft. And nobody at the time, as crazy as it sounds, no one had a clue that Michael Jordan would become the greatest player of all time. He wasn't drafted one. He wasn't even drafted two. And so I had a very close relationship with the head of marketing at Nike. And I said, look, if you want to sign Jordan, I want it to be like a tennis player, like McEnroe or Bjorn Borg or Arthur Ashe. I want him to have his own line of shoes and clothes. And Nike at the time was the underdog. Converse dominated American basketball. Adidas dominated world sports, and Nike was a very small company that I happened to have a very close relationship with. And the head of marketing, Rob Strasser, said to me, we might be willing to give him his own line. What do you want to call it? Now, in the world of marketing, when a player, when an athlete has his own line of products, it's either called a signature line because he puts his name on it, or an autograph line. That's what it's called. And so I said, what do I want to call it? I want to call it Michael Jordan. And he said, no. And I looked at him like he was like losing his mind. I said, well, why not? And he said, David, no one's going to believe that a 21-year-old college athlete's going to come into the pros and sit in an apartment at night and be designing shoes and clothes. It has no credibility. And he gave a few different reasons. And he said, we may be willing to give you a line, but you can't call it Michael Jordan. So if you can come up with a good name, we'll consider a line. And I wanted to strangle him. We're sitting in my office in August on a Saturday, on a weekend. The air conditioning's turned off. It's about 90 degrees in D.C. and humid. We're sweating our buns off. And the guy's giving me the most unreasonable challenge I've ever had in my career. And I don't know, something clicked in my mind. And Nike had just come out with a brand new technology for their running shoes called air soles that was supposed to give your foot great cushioning. And I said, okay, I want to tell you exactly what I said because I don't want to be bleeped out by your viewers, but I said, okay, blank, we're going to call it Air Jordan. Air for the air soles and the technology. And
there
air
you go. The rest is history.
And the rest is history. Now, to give you a sense of what the market was like, because you're asking, when we signed the contract, Nike's goal in 1984 was to have the sales of Air Jordan by 1988, by the summer of 88, between the third and fourth year of his contract. Their goal was to have the sales be $3 billion. And in the first year, we sold $126 million.
Whoa.
We outsold every shoe company in the world at basketball in year one. So when you ask what did people expect, no one had a clue that Michael Jordan on the court or off the court could be the dominating greatest player of all time, greatest marketer of all time. It just was in no one's comprehension.
And David, just a quick follow-up to that. Did it help that he was drafted by Chicago in that market? I mean, could this have all been possible even if Michael was the same exact player if he played in Portland? Did the Chicago market being as big as it was, I know the Bulls were not good, of course, but being in Chicago, did that help things along?
I mean, not really, honestly. I think if he'd been in Portland, You know, I think Michael would have been a great player if he played on the moon. Okay. I mean, he's Michael Jordan and he's so competitive and he's so diligent and he was a student of the game. I'll tell you a story. Like years after Michael stopped playing, we're in his brother's house, Larry, in Charlotte, and we're watching the finals between the Lakers and the Celtics. And Michael, as you know, he came to the funeral, loved Kobe Bryant. So Kobe's playing against Paul Pierce, and Michael is screaming at the TV, at Kobe, through the screen, and he's saying, damn it, like, straddle his right knee. And I said, like, what on earth does that mean? He said, David, Paul Pierce is the only right-handed player in the NBA that pivots off his right foot. Every other player pivots off his left foot. So if Kobe straddles his right knee, Pierce will be able to go to his left. Now, Michael wasn't great simply because he was really athletic. He was amazingly athletic. He was a student of the game. He studied the game. He was taught the game by one of the greatest coaches in college basketball history, Dean Smith. And he willed himself to be a great player. He put everything he had into being a great player.
It's a great story.
There are very few guys like that today. I mean, I think LeBron's a great player. I think Kevin Durant's a great player. But I don't think there'll ever be a player that has the talent, the drive, the family, the college pedigree. I mean, he had everything. If you're going to recreate science, if you're going to put Michael in a laboratory, it would take you know, a bolt of lightning to energize the mix to recreate him. I don't think there'll ever be another Michael Jordan. There'll be a lot of great players, and there have been a lot of great players. And Michael, because he's so comfortable in his own skin, totally defies all the comparisons with everyone that people wants to compare him to. He says that's up to the fans. That's why he's so smart. Like doesn't want to get involved. He doesn't want to get involved in these mono comparisons. You're comparing different eras, different rules. I think if Michael played in today's rules with no hand checking, I think he'd average between 50 and 60 a game. I think he'd shoot 75% from the floor. He'd be completely unstoppable.
We're talking to David Falk, longtime Jordan agent. We're out of time, but I have a quick speed round for you. Yeah, I have a quick speed round for you. Did Michael talk to you in the years since he retired about wishing that he could have finished his career in Chicago instead of Washington?
No, I tell him that all the time. But listen, Ted Leonsis was a great second-generation mentor to Michael. We brought Michael to Washington for Ted, even though Michael and I had a terrible relationship with Abe Pollin. We did it for Ted, who I have tremendous admiration for. And I never expected he'd play again. We brought him to be an owner and to learn technology and learn business, you know, and he ended up on the court. But that was not in the plan.
What player do you most regret not getting to represent?
That's really easy. Grant Hill. You know, Grant knows I love him to death. He's a D.C. guy. He committed to us, but one of his parents, I won't say who, thought that he could save money by going with a lawyer who billed about the hour, so he saved about $1 million in agent's fees and lost about $100 million in salary.
Oh, man. All right, and before we let you go, I know you're known for being very honest, brash with your clients. You even challenged Dikembe Mutombo's pending nuptials over an unsigned prenuptial agreement. I'm wondering if you ever had a big clash with Michael where he disagreed with your advice.
Many times, but the biggest one was he got involved in a gambling problem because one of our former clients, Al Wood, who's a Carolina guy, invited Michael to play golf with a felon who was being tracked by the FBI for money laundering. And Michael lost a lot of money to the guy. He didn't do anything wrong. And it really blew up all over the media. And so I'm watching a Bulls game, and Michael comes to the post-game press conference wearing sunglasses, looked like freaking Stevie Wonder. And I knew we had a big problem. So I got out of the plane the next morning and flew to Chicago. At the airport, I picked up the Chicago Tribune, and Jesse Jackson, who was a giant at the time, was in the headline, said Michael Jordan can hang out with whoever he wants. So we sat down after practice. I said, MJ, you know, you didn't commit a crime. You didn't commit a felony. You didn't rob a bank. You didn't kill anybody. But you made a terrible mistake in judgment by being with this guy, and it's having a lot of reverberations. Just come out and say you're sorry. And he got really angry at me. It was the only time in my career I ever thought he'd fire me. And he said, I knew you were going to say that. All you care about is the endorsements. And I said, Michael, I don't give a shit about the endorsements. I'll cancel them all tomorrow. But if you want to tell young kids that you want to be a role model, you can't hang out with convicted, with suspected felons. So, pick your poison. Either, hang out whatever you want, and we'll cancel the deals, or be a role model, and you have to be a little more disciplined. And he was seething. Honestly, he was so angry. But when you represent someone, we talked about this literally an hour ago on the phone, Michael and I, about this philosophy. If you're an agent and you're representing a player, the one thing he's got to count on you is that in crunch time, if he's in a problem, you're going to give him your best advice. You're not going to tell him what he thinks he wants to hear. You're going to tell him what he needs to hear, whether he likes it or not. And I think that the strength of my relationship with Michael for, almost 40 years is that he always knew in crunch time, he may not agree with me, that I would give him what I thought was my best advice. And that night, after he was angry, they played another game. He went to the press conference, no sunglasses, and he apologized. He said, I embarrassed my parents. I embarrassed my college coach. I embarrassed the Bulls. I'm sorry. And it went away. Now, do you think I enjoyed confronting Michael Jordan at the height of his career?
Of course not.
No.
Right.
It wasn't fun. It wasn't something I look forward to. But, there are a lot of great things that you inherit when you represent a player who's the greatest player of all time. And it's the greatest honor for me that Michael trusted me for the length of his entire career. I mean, there's not a higher compliment in the game. But there's a price to pay, and the price is that you have to do things from time to time that people are going to resent you for. You have to say no a lot to people that want him to do things that he doesn't want to do. And you have to take the good and the bad.
Yeah.
And for me, representing someone of that caliber was a challenge to me every day. I wanted to give him my A game. I never wanted to show up and say, hey, I'm tired, I got a headache, I had a bad night last night.
You had to be the Michael Jordan of agents, right? It feels like it worked out. You both had to bring 100% every time, even when it was tough. Oh gosh, we could talk to you forever. This is fascinating stuff, and I get the feeling we're going to see more and hear from you throughout this
documentary. I want to say one last thing before we go, if I could steal one more time. So I haven't seen the documentary yet. I'm really looking forward to watching it Sunday night. Michael Tolan is a very dear friend of mine who produced it. But I want to give your viewers a preview of what the documentary is about. So there are times in your life when the sand is running out of the hourglass. You only have so much time left to accomplish something that's really, really important to you. And the most important thing to Michael from the day he stepped on the court in the NBA in 1984 to the day he retired for the last time, was winning.